Thank you. Thanks very much indeed. Does that work? Yeah, great. Put your hands up and things. The handouts, if you didn't get one, then it's not crucial. It's just a few notes and there's a couple of images on there. But I can put it on my website, of course, being multimedia, if that would be useful as well. So scream and shout at the end if that would be of any use. Thank you very much for lasting till Monday afternoon. And I'm going to do most of the work in this session, so if that's a comfort. But I would be great to take some questions and things. So if I talk maybe for about 40 minutes or so, and then if there's questions or points, conversations, things that you'd like to raise, that'd be really good to have as well. So do keep those in store. I'll make time for that for sure. I wanted to talk about the notion that Jesus might have been some kind of philosopher. Sometimes this appears in the media. I think George Bush was once asked, you know, who's your favorite philosopher? And he said, Jesus. It came about for me because of this journey, if you like, that I've been on, that I used to be an Anglican clergyman, and then for various reasons that didn't work out. Nothing too scandalous, but just because it wasn't me. And I left a sort of an atheist, mostly on the rebound, I guess. And now I find myself in the sort of agnostic middle, still keen and interested in these questions. And it was really I did a PhD on Plato and discovering something about what ancient philosophy might really be about that was one way back into these religious questions. And so this idea that that philosophy and Christianity in particular, but Judaism and other forms of religion might well be closer to philosophy than we first think these days. Is something that energizes me and interests me, and that's what I wanted to share something of with you this afternoon, and maybe say why this might matter, rather than just being a kind of existential, a philosophical question, an academic question, why it might actually be something which would be useful and interesting in our times, in the place we find ourselves at the beginning of the 21st century. I think that it's partly a kind of quest for the historical Jesus kind of question. You know, this was the project which was launched about a century ago, a little more than that now, by individuals like Albert Schweitzer, who, following the biblical criticism movements, started to ask, well, who was the person Jesus, as opposed to the figure of Christ or the image remembered throughout Christian history. And since then, there have been, many historical Jesuses have emerged, and a few have kind of stuck with some plausibility. My feeling probably is actually the historical Jesus is probably lost to us, and that what happened was what sometimes biblical scholars talk about as the Jesus event. There was this historical individual. He, for various reasons, which I'll touch on, sparked a tremendous response in the people that knew him and that surrounded him. And then, after his death, there was this effort which lasted, through the period of the Bible, the New Testament being written, and then particularly in the first five centuries when the doctrines of Christianity were formulated, and then ever since, where people tried to make some sense of what this thing had been, what this encounter had been, what this life might mean. And they drew on all sorts of ideas and images and resources that were around and about at the time, and we still do that to this day. So partly this idea of the philosopher Jesus might make sense in that context, and that's one thing I'll be talking about. Another thing is a bit more contemporary. There's been, if you're I hope there's not too many biblical scholars actually in the audience, because I might ride rather roughshod over their careful studies, but I think it's fair to say that there's been a tendency in recent scholarship to be very, to focus on the Jewishness of Jesus. When I did my theology degree, and there was a very well-known book by E.P. Saunders called Jesus the Jew, and this has been a kind of common currency, particularly I think since the Second War. And I think what that's about is it's an indirect way of trying to deal with Christian anti-Semitism since the war. And by emphasizing the Jewishness of Jesus, that has been a way of saying Christian anti-Semitism has been mistaken and misplaced and wrong. We actually, our founder, as it were, was a Jew too. Now, there's been a lot in that, there's no doubt about that. But I think maybe it's time for a bit of a corrective. This desire, as it were, to separate the Jewishness of Jesus from other currents which are increasingly being recognised in the Middle East at the time, in Palestine at the time. That's a new corrective, and you can quite easily find books now which talk about maybe how Judaism was quite close in many respects to ancient Greek philosophy, for example. There's been books written about the temple that emphasise that. And similarly, individuals who are mentioned who have looked at how actually ancient Greek philosophy might well have touched even rural Palestine, where Jesus was born and raised. And that is interesting, as is the way that these people who wrote the Bible, who tried to formulate the doctrines and explore what the Jesus event meant, drew on various bits of ancient Greek philosophy very productively and interestingly. Did something with it, as it were, and but in order to try and understand what had happened. So I want to talk about that a little bit too. But also, finally, you know, why might this matter? Why might this be more than just an academic question? I think it might matter to us now because, in some ways, the ancient world of that period, from the death of Socrates through to the life of Christ and beyond, was quite a plural age. Really, until Constantine, until Christianity became the official religion of the Roman Empire, many different philosophical and religious strands coexisted, sometimes with conflict, sometimes quite happily, and drew syncretistically from each other. And again, that can be a very productive stance, a very productive place to be, as it were, in the history of ideas, because it's about trying to translate deep intuitions, deep experiences, and deep encounters into words that can help discern, can expand, can create culture and arts and so on from those experiences. And maybe I think we live in a period that's quite like that now in some ways. You know, if after Alexander the Great there was a period of globalization, you might say, certainly from, well, these islands through to the Hindu Kush, so now we're very conscious of living in a plural age, a globalized age, and you know, Western ideas meet Eastern ideas. That too certainly happened at the time of Plato and before. So maybe this syncretism and this trying to grapple with difference in order to make sense of experience is something which could be useful for us too. That's certainly where I would find myself to be, in fact. So maybe asking this question about the philosophy of Jesus is a way of sparking the imagination of how we might do that again these days. So that's broadly the kind of area which I wanted to talk about, how the Jesus event at the time people used philosophical ideas, how maybe there's a need for a bit of a corrective to think about the Greekness of Jesus as well as the Jewishness of Jesus, and then also that might be quite a useful thing to do existentially, because we too live in a kind of plural syncretistic age where various currents of thought can come together in interesting and new ways. That's broadly what I wanted to say. Perhaps I should just take one step back, which is the first point on the fly. I'm going to say more than on the fly, but this is the fly beginning now. Which is to say that ancient Greek philosophy wasn't really anything like philosophy as we think of it today. And a useful image is to imagine ancient Greek philosophers as more like monks than like academics. They certainly didn't have tenure. And they didn't give lectures, and Plato would have thought examinations were a complete disaster because examinations are checkbox activities, in effect, whereas he was interested in how one might live and change one's life. The personal encounter, if you like, was what mattered to him, and hence he wrote dialogues, dialogues being encounters between real individuals on the streets of Athens. They certainly have very involved conversations, don't get me wrong on that, but they're there as people, as whole persons. Their emotions are there, their histories are there. And philosophy, as it were, is done in life, not on the page. First mistake, again, I don't want to offend too many academic philosophers if they're in the room, but it's a bit of a mistake, I think, for to treat philosophy as if it is mostly done on the page and in books. I think it's primarily done in life. And certainly Plato and the people that followed Socrates would have thought that. And there's a nice little synchronicity here that, again, helps to focus on that in the year 529, which was the year that Plato's Academy was finally shut in Athens. So it had lasted for about 900 years. It had been a sort of powerhouse of ideas and inspiration for about 900 years. Finally shut in 529. That was more or less the same year, plus or minus a year. I'm not quite sure, but it seems about that year that Benedict opened his monastery in Monte Cassino in Italy. And the first monks wanted to live their ideas out in their lives, construct a way of life that can enable them to inhabit these questions and these this vision they were pursuing. And Benedict, in a way, does that with theology in the way that Plato and his followers and others had done with philosophy. The first monks adopted some of the clothing of the ancient philosophers. Some philosophers walked around carrying staffs, wearing gowns, wearing beards, and that kind of thing. In a way, it's a sort of handing of the baton, I think. Something which got lost as education became more professionalised and so on, but nonetheless is there still today, and certainly was there in the 6th century in 529. And then the other more sort of profound and more slippery idea here is that both, I think, Socrates and Jesus were what the philosopher Karl Jaspers called axial figures. The axial age is this rather extended period of time, maybe over 6 or 7 centuries. Some historians don't like it at all, but it seems to be a useful idea where broadly philosophical questions, religious questions turned inward. Put very crudely, religion became much less about how you can control the environment and became more about how to change yourself. There seems to have been a kind of inward turn. And various figures stand out through this period. Confucius would be one, the Buddha would be another. Jesus and Socrates are often referred to as being these individuals too. And what's very striking about all these individuals is that they wrote nothing. You can't actually read a single word that Socrates wrote. You can't read a single word that Jesus wrote. There's that tantalizing moment in the Bible where he writes on the ground and then the wind comes along and blows it away. And it's almost as if that's to say, you know, the written word is second best. It's the life that counts. If you want to do a little midrash on that moment. Of course, plenty of followers then write down and reconstruct and imagine and so on words. We need the tradition, if you like, in order to preserve something of the encounter. But we must always, I think, go beyond to the encounter. So these axial figures, Confucius, Buddha, but particularly Jesus and Socrates, I think a way to understand them is they seem to have been figures that capture something fundamental about the human condition and in their lives crystallize that. So they have this tremendous impact upon the people around them. They, as it were, release a kind of nascent energy that then takes on a life of its own, becomes a kind of spirit of the age, can't be put down, refuses to be quiet. If you're into Jungian psychology, then these are kind of instantiations of archetypes, these kind of nodal energies in the collective unconscious. If this is familiar language to you, these individuals bring this about in their own lives. And so, although they wrote nothing, we still talk about them, which is a pretty remarkable fact if you think about it, but that captures something of their importance. So I think there's parallels there, certainly between Socrates and Jesus. Now, just to move on a bit more to the philosophers, the one I was going to talk about mostly was Plato. Plato, again, this is going too far, but he's something like the Paul of ancient Greek philosophy. Paul didn't know Jesus in life, but had this encounter with the risen Christ. Similarly, Plato did know Socrates. He was taught by Socrates. But Plato, as it were, is the main voice who gives us this very rich and complex and interesting and moving portrait of this person, Socrates, in the dialogues. And when you do ancient Greek philosophy, you know, Plato is the kind of the giant, if you like, along with Aristotle and the Stoics and Epicureans, others who follow on from Socrates in different ways. It's also, I think, important to note that there are differences. You know, this isn't syncretism without differences. This isn't trying to meld everything into one big perennial philosophy. I actually don't find that very persuasive. I think that differences really count because we're individual people. Our individuality is very important in terms of the spiritual quest. And individuality means that we're different. And so differences matter as much as oneness, as it were, as much as gathering. A Socratic spirituality, I think, would be full of arguments and tensions and disagreements. And because it's in those moments of difference that we become individuated, we become real individuals and not just people that walk around with kind of glazed looks on our faces with a personality somewhere left behind. So there are clear differences between Jesus and Socrates, Plato. The Socrates we encounter in the dialogues of Plato. So, for example, Jesus, it seems more or less certain, called God Father. Plato didn't have much conception of a personal God. To the ancient Greeks, the idea that you might treat a god as somehow a person like you would have been not maybe made much sense, because that would have been to collapse the difference between mortals and the immortals, between the finite and the infinite. So they personified gods in statuary and so on, but a bit like icons, the idea was to always look through the personification to see that which lay beyond. So I think the idea of calling God Father would have been a bit peculiar to Plato. He preferred to refer to things like the good, the true, the beautiful, the beatific vision, that kind of thing. So that would be a difference. Another difference is that Jesus taught resurrection, it seems more or less certain, and certainly people have remembered him as resurrected. And whereas Plato was a Pythagorean, that was one of the important strands for him, and the Pythagoreans believe in a form of reincarnation. They talk about the transmigration of souls, so that would be a different thing. Jesus, I think, had little to say about erotic love, whereas for Plato, erotic love was almost the whole story, actually. And in this particular way, he thought that to be human was to be what he called an in-between creature. Unlike other animals, presumably, who just go about their everyday lives and are more or less ignorant, as it were, of what they're doing. They're not self-reflective, we presume. For Plato, can become conscious of that ignorance. We can know that we don't know, if you like. And this is both a great blessing, because it fires our creativity, our innovation, our desire for more, our taste for the transcendent, our love, in the broadest sense. This is what he meant by the word love. And it can also be a curse, because it can drive you to frustration, to destruction, all the bad things that love can do too. And as Iris Murdoch put it, in a way, the great struggle in life for Plato is to channel this energy aright, through developing character, habits, and so on. What do we do with our love, if you like, is the great question for Plato. Now, that's kind of there in the New Testament, but in a slightly different way, which I'll come back to. So, differences over this question of love and the role that love plays. Jesus was known as a healer of the body. Plato was known as a healer of the soul. There's a difference there. There are records of the Neoplatonists conducting miracles, but not Plato himself. So that would be a slight difference to whatever you make of that. And then, of course, Jesus died at the hands of a Roman executioner, whereas Plato, it is said, died at his writing desk calmly and serenely. So Socrates, of course, died executed as well, but Plato didn't. But there are similarities, and these are quite interesting. Jesus taught love of enemies, as I guess you'll know, and Plato too argued that love of enemies was, in a way, the highest form of interpersonal love. And he argued, basically, what's the virtue in loving your friends? That's what it is to have a friend. Those who love their enemies are the moral inspirations for us. This is argued out in the Republic. They both had very unconventional views about the family. Plato forms the Academy, his kind of teaching school, it was pretty socially subversive at the time. There were women there, for example, and some of the women which we know by name from that period in history, some of the rare individual women we know by name, are because they were followers of Plato. Slaves, too, were involved as well. As you might know, in the Republic, which I think is a kind of experimental philosophy, a bit of politics. It's more like Thomas More's Utopia. It's not supposed to be a manifesto. It's supposed to be a kind of thought experiment to draw out some of the principles which might be required in ordering a society. Plato thought that families were very unsettling notions in society, because they tend to form factions, and they're basis of tribes, they cause division and so on. So he had this very radical communistic view in the Republic, whereby, you know, children should be shared, the upbringing of children should be shared, there should be a much broader kind of sense of community, as it were, than the nuclear family would seem to allow. So unconventional, challenging views about family. You know, similarly, Jesus says, you know, what have you got to do to me, with me, to his mother? And he tells you to leave the dead to bury their dead, to leave brothers and sisters and so on. Very challenging views about the family. Again, whether or not they're meant literally, or whether they're supposed to challenge in a more prophetic mode, I would incline to that, but that would seem to be a similarity. They were both very clear that the spirit of the law is what counts, and not the letter of the law. This reflects back to this business about how change and living more fully the good life, living this the kingdom of God in the biblical language, is done in lives. It's not actually done on the page. The page is important, but it's done in lives. And so the spirit counts more than the written rule of the law. And although both Plato and Jesus, it seems, Plato wrote laws, he wrote a whole book called The Laws, and Jesus too seemed to capture certain things in as summaries of laws, at least, if not more detailed laws. They were always sort of second best. I think that's pretty clear. The spirit, as it were, always has this antinomian streak. That would be a similar thing. They both were quite keen on the idea of judgment after we die. Plato invented new myths, actually, and re-created old myths about what happens when you die and what you do in this life and will count in some way. Whether it counts in a kind of balance, i.e. if you've done enough goods, then you go to a good place, or whether it's more intentions and so on that count, sort of the passion with which you've lived life, the seriousness, the integrity which you've had in life, as opposed to a sort of checkbox good and evil that you've done. I think perhaps, again, more the spirit with which you've lived life would count more. And that seems to be, at least in some parts of the New Testament, an idea that would have similar kind of resonance with judgment. You know, it's a big debate in the history of Christianity whether faith saves you one-off or whether faith should inspire a life and the life you lead counts as well. But broad similarities there, this question about judgment after death anyway. And also an interesting one, neither charged for their teaching. Perhaps this wasn't such a big deal in Jesus' day. Maybe the idea of wandering prophets and teachers and so on, rabbis, was more common. But in Plato's day, and for Socrates, it was a big deal. And in fact, Socrates seems to have loathed a group of philosophers who did charge for their teaching, who were known as the Sophists. And he thought that the risk there was that you taught people to come up with clever arguments in order to win in the law courts, for example, rather than to do work on your own life. He thought that if money changes hands, that's just going to start to spoil everything. And so famously, he didn't charge. And his wife, apparently, Socrates' wife, hated him for it because she was the one that had to live in the poverty at home. But nonetheless, that seems to be an important principle, the business about money and charging. Now, does this all add up to whether or not Jesus was a philosopher, though, in any kind of meaningful sense? There are sort of three steps towards this, which I want to suggest. First of all, I think it's very clear that when the first followers of Jesus, through particularly in the first century, but then through in the first five centuries, when they were trying to make sense of this Jesus event, they definitely drew on philosophy. And there are two ways you can see it very clearly. One is by drawing on Stoic philosophy. The Stoics were one group of ancient Greek philosophers that came after Socrates. They were had, as you like, one set of responses to the Socrates event. And they taught things like, for example, when we say things like go with the flow, that comes from the ancient Greek Stoics. The Stoics thought that there's a benign sort of tendency or force or rule, if you like, that goes through life. And life goes well for us as individuals when we can align ourselves with that flow, with that force, with that spirit. And they called that force spirit flow logos. This Greek word logos, it's translated as words, but it's a very rich word that means a lot more than that. It can mean conversation, it can mean principle, it can mean tendency, all sorts of things. And the Stoics certainly talked about the logos, and they thought the logos was benign, it would lead you in good ways. And so, as a famous Stoic, Chrysippus, talked about, our lives should be like cylinders that tumble down the side of a hill. And we should just let ourselves tumble with the force of gravity. And when we try and move in a different direction, it's like being kicked by a sharp stone. It's just a waste of energy. You're not going to be able to win in the end anyway. You might as well trust the logos. It can be trusted, and learn to go with the flow. That way lies tranquility. So the Stoics and this idea of logos was around. It's well known to have been picked up by a Jew called Philo of Alexandria, who kind of developed it with a bit of a Jewish slant on it, if you like. And then it seems that this is picked up in the Johannine texts, when John writes, "In the beginning was the logos," translated orthodoxy as the word. You may know that Erasmus, when he did his translation at the time of Reformation, translated it, "In the beginning was the conversation." but that didn't sort of win the day. That seems to have been something which was borrowed from the Stoics. The idea that Jesus was the instantiation of this good force, this good spirit, this rule or principle, that's what the incarnation means, at least in part. They're broad ideas. They're more poetic in a way. They can gather a lot of stuff to them. But the Stoic ideas seem to be resonating around when people try to make sense of what the incarnation might mean, how you might make this encounter stand up, as it were, give it some roots. There's also lots of Platonism in the Bible. This partly comes out, as I was sort of suggesting earlier on, in relation to the discussion about love. Again, a Johannine notion predominantly. I was in a debate once with a rather conservative Christianity, and I was being all liberal and preaching God is love. And he said to me, do you know how many times is written in the Bible God is love? Anyone know? Apparently it's written three times, and twice in one of the Johannine letters. So this was a nice sort of debating factoid. But I think, generally speaking, the idea of God and love is one that runs throughout the New Testament and certainly in the Johannine texts. And this would be a Platonic idea. And it comes about in this way, that if you know Plato's Symposium, which is one of his best-known dialogues and one of the ones which is about love, he has Socrates telling a bunch of Greeks about his experience with a priestess called Diotima. And he says that Diotima taught him everything he knew. And particularly everything he knew about love. And he knows about love because although he's very conscious of his ignorance, there's one thing he knows, is that he knows nothing for sure. That sparks this desire to know, this desire for more, this desire to create for the beyond, for the transcendent. And so paradoxically, although if you know nothing, you actually do know something quite a lot about love, because love is very connected to desire and the desire for what you don't have. So Socrates says that I discovered everything I knew about this with this priestess called Diotima. And Diotima teaches Socrates lower mysteries and higher mysteries, as Plato puts it. And the higher mysteries are a kind of encounter with the divine. It's well known as the ladder of love, the ascent of love. And what Socrates describes is how the everyday experience of falling in love, when we our desire, if you like, is sparked by another person, another body, the physical desire of love, sexual desire, erotic desire. We shouldn't get sort of trapped on that love, but this should be a springboard to this ladder of love. And first of all, we love the person and we make a life together. Lovers, as it were, move from staring into each other's eyes to gazing straight ahead. And together in life, one can pursue other interests, other concerns, other passions. Plato was a mathematician, and he thought that mathematics should be part of this for sure, the beautiful equation. No one who doesn't know geometry can come to his academy, apparently said above the doors of the school. But this is some kind of aesthetic notion, the beautifulness of forms. Then similarly with ideas, philosophy, poetry. And then eventually you reach a kind of a pinnacle, you climb this ladder, as it were, where you see Socrates in this dialogue calls the beautiful in itself, that which is unalloyed and never changes and sort of blows your mind, if you like. The good, the beautiful, and the true. And the idea is not that you kind of have that vision and then stay there. Life is not like that. Life has moments where you capture glimpses of this beatific vision of the divine. Often we're down the lower rungs of the ladder, if you like, but once seen, never forgotten, you might say, or once even intimated, once you get the whiff of it, the smell of it, you can't quite put it down. And I think it speaks to us pretty directly, really. It's a very fundamental notion that's run through the Western tradition, and it does so because of Christianity. Christianity picked this up, very soon, perhaps not so much in the Bible itself, but certainly in the first five centuries, the people that set down the format, the shape, the contours, as it were, of Christianity, drew a lot on this kind of idea that love could lead to the divine. And that's partly where it comes from. I think it's also there, actually, in notions of the Spirit, the Holy Spirit, too. The link here would be that Eros, the personification of erotic love in ancient Greek thought, was a demon. And demons weren't bad guys to the ancient Greeks. They were just go-betweens. They were kind of mythical ways of talking about the forces that move between us and that move between us and the gods. Certainly Plato has Socrates say, Eros is actually not a god. Eros is a demon, and it's a force of spirit that brings us, that speaks to us of the immortal, of the transcendent, of the most beautiful, of the most true. And there's something rattling around there with notions of the doctrine of the Holy Spirit as well, I think. So that's Platonism. A lot of the Stoicism, particularly around these ideas of logos, it's there in the morality, particularly in Pauline morality too. A lot of Paul's ideas about morality are broadly Stoic ideas, but also the Platonic ideas. And again, a cluster of these things gather around this notion of love. So the Jesus event certainly inspired philosophical ideas to draw towards it, to make sense of this moment. But was Jesus himself a philosopher? And the most plausible way of saying yes to a degree is done on this work on another group of philosophers that I haven't mentioned yet, which is the Cynic philosophers, the Cynics. Now, cynics doesn't mean cynicism as we tend to mean it. It doesn't mean sort of morbid skepticism. Cynic comes from the Greek word for dog, and the Cynics were well known for living these lives like dogs. They lived very ascetic lives. They walked around just carrying staves with one satchel over their shoulder. If you've got the handout, there's a little image there of an ancient Greek cynic. And the iconography, in a way, says much more than the words. They kind of look a bit like a lot of iconography of Jesus. And I think that's no coincidence. Socrates inspired this sort of one response to him, because he too was well known for example, not wearing shoes. He went around Athens not wearing shoes. It wasn't very hygienic. This was partly saying, look, you know, he didn't say this, someone else said this, but look at the birds of the air, look at the lilies of the field. And that kind of sentiment, that ascetic sentiment, seems to have been around in the ancient Greek philosophy, particularly through this line of philosophers called the Cynics. On the handout, there's just this phrase, which apparently a cynic said, "O people, where are you bound? O miserable ones, what are you doing? You reel up and down like the blind. You've left the real path and are going off on another one." Ancient Greek cynics could be heard saying that 400 or 500 years before Jesus. And, of course, Jesus said not dissimilar things, perhaps, too. There's a few sayings which I've just made a note of here that Jesus said, which seem to carry cynic sentiments too. For example, carry no purse, no bag, no satchel, nor two tunics. Whatever house you enter, eat what is set before you. Heal the sick in it and say to them, the kingdom of God has come upon you. Apart from the kingdom of God, but that's quite Jewish language, but the business about going around with just a purse and a bag and so on. What goes into your mouth does not defile you, but what comes out of your mouth, that will defile you. No prophet is acceptable in his own village. No physician heals those who know him. And the cynics upset a lot of people and were typically had confrontations with authorities. If you know anything about the cynics, you'll know that Diogenes the cynic, who famously lived in a barrel, he said it was just too much hassle finding a house, just live in a barrel. He had this famous encounter with Alexander the Great. There's a story one day that Alexander the Great comes to see Diogenes. So Alexander, the man who owns everything, Diogenes, the man who owns nothing. And Alexander says, "Diogenes, what can I give you?" And Diogenes says, "Do you mind stepping out of the sun? You're casting a shadow over me." There's nothing Alexander can give Diogenes, a cynic. And that encounter with authority and the kind of complete unmasking of authority, if you like, maybe there's echoes of that in the story of Jesus before Pilate as well. So that seems to be a kind of strand. The most intriguing sort of tangible piece of evidence, if you're really into textual evidence, is the story of Legion in the New Testament. Legion, you'll remember, who was the guy possessed with a legion of demons. And the reason why it's an intriguing encounter is because Legion lives in the city of Gadara, on the other side of the Sea of Galilee. It's actually quite a long way from the Sea of Galilee, if you've ever been there, but there's a story about the pigs leaving Legion and running into the sea. They must have run for quite a long way. Maybe it's just a joke. The Gadara. And the reason why Gadara is interesting is because Gadara was known as the city of the philosophers. In this broader sense, these inspirational figures, these prophets that come out of Gadara. And we know from history that three cynics, one Epicurean, two rhetoricians, one mathematician, and one Neoplatonist, all came from Gadara, and there would have been others. They're just ones we can name. And the idea is that in this story, is remembered an encounter between, as it were, Jesus, the Jewish cynic, and Legion, whose real name is lost, the ancient Greek cynic. These two different strands of ascetic, prophetic life, if you like. Jesus is the winner in the encounter, and so we get the story which doesn't show Legion up in a very good light. Some kind of encounter here, some kind of tension, and this has been picked up in a very scholarly way by John Dominic Crossand, who wrote a big book called The Historical Jesus and many other books too. He's one of these people who, since Albert Schweitzer, has tried to pursue who the historical Jesus might have been, and he puts the case for Jesus being a kind of cynic philosopher. There's a number of parts to this discussion, as you might imagine, which we could go into in the questions if you like. I've read the book, know something about it anyway. I put a quote there on the handout which said something of why there are similarities but also differences, again, different strands, so hence you get the encounter, and Jesus wins the day, as it were. There's a kind of these ideas are all rattling around Palestine, if you like, and Jesus represents one strand. If you want the idea of Jesus being a philosopher, that's probably the way to go, that Jesus was a cynic philosopher. Certainly, later Christians, later followers of Jesus, drew on philosophical ideas, particularly Platonism, particularly the Stoicism. But Jesus himself, I think we can more or less certainly say now, Jesus would have known about ancient Greek philosophy. Again, it used to be thought that that he was a rural Jew and wouldn't have had much experience or encounters with these basically urban ideas. You'll know the story about Jesus in the temple as a child, and when he impressed all the scribes and the rabbis. Again, if you've ever been to the Holy Land, you'll know that these places are actually pretty close together. And in fact, in Tiberias and various places, ancient Greek temples are found, and whether there were temples, there are always teachings. So it seems pretty likely that Jesus would have known about these ideas too, and may well have been inspired, as it were, when he was himself, whatever happened in his life, when he was trying to make some sense of his own encounter with God. The cynics perhaps inspired him in a certain kind of way, and he was able to develop his own theology of the kingdom and his radically ascetic way of life by drawing on that tradition. Maybe he met a cynic philosopher, and maybe there was even the encounter across the Sea of Galilee with this figure, Legion. As I said at the start, I actually think the historical Jesus is lost to us. I think that that Christianity is a constantly evolving thing because it lives. That's the cost, as it were, if you like, for a tradition that lives. It's constantly remade, and whilst part of that remaking is to take what's received, it's to try and do something with what's received and make something new for the future. So there's a constant kind of organic process going on here. So I wouldn't want you to go away thinking I was the champion of Jesus as a cynic. In a way, it's more of a kind of a thought experiment, just to open up, in a way, what we don't know in true Socratic spirit, to spark our imaginations, as it were, to expand the mystery of this axial figure, Jesus. And in fact, you can do the same for the axial figure called Socrates and the others too. But we're focusing particularly on Jesus today. So the quest will be perennial now, but the idea is, as it were, for it to work in your own life now. So that's why these are useful imaginative stories, narratives, thought experiments to engage in. That'd be one point to take. But as I say, you know, we live today in a plural world. We live in a world of tension and contrast, a world where there are a lot of different ideas around and about. And it's very easy to fall into the habit of just defending what you take to be your own tradition, your own core idea, and defending it against what might be imagined to be the onslaught of other ideas. The lust for certainty, as it's been said, the desire to preserve your own tradition against all attacks or encounters with others. But I think that if the religious quest is part of what it is to be human, if at the end of the day we are connecting with something which is beyond us and beneath us and through us, and we're broadly monotheistic, as Plato was, as the Jewish tradition, Christian tradition certainly is, we're looking for something more than just the defense of our own tradition. We're looking for the way that this might be manifest in other traditions too. So you do develop, I think, some kind of theology of pluralism. Again, a huge area, different models around and about that are constantly being corrected and adjusted and thought through. But maybe this idea of Jesus, the philosopher, is a way of doing that for our age, for not, as it were, fearing the other, but looking for the way that the other can speak to you too. Eastern ideas would be an obvious example of that for us now. We're becoming, I think, more and more conscious, particularly of Buddhism in the West. But as China becomes more and more significant in our imagination, so too will other ideas from the Far East. That's already there in Plato, in fact. Plato, too, the Pythagoreans, drew from ideas from India. If you've ever been to Taxila in modern-day Pakistan, that seems to have been a place where East met West, and then ideas came back into and fed into Western philosophy. So in a way, they're already there, and we just have to kind of draw them out afresh and to muse on them afresh. But in a way, if I'm not arguing for the Jesus the Cynic as a completely robust thesis, I'm arguing for some idea of being open to a new moment in time, which in some ways mirrors the first Christian moment, and certainly the centuries that followed on from Socrates, when people tried to make sense of these extraordinary individuals that seem to speak directly to the human condition in ways which are too much to grasp. But nonetheless, you want to, as it were, commit your life to trying to understand in some way or other. That would be the broad idea of contemplating the notion of Jesus the philosopher. Now, I have spoken for my 40 minutes, and indeed a little bit more. So I hope I've sparked thoughts and questions, whether they're very practical questions, whether they're comments, disagreements, whatever you like. We've got at least 10 minutes to take. Great, there's some hands going up, so that's very good. I don't know if there's a mic thing, but yeah.
Yeah, if you keep your hand in the air, we'll try and get two or three questions.
Thank you.
Yes, you said a bit about the Buddha, but I wonder if you could say a bit more. I regard myself as a Buddhist Christian, and one thing I like about the philosopher Jesus is that it makes him much more like the Buddha in his teaching. If you have a very Jewish or apocalyptic Jesus, he's quite remote and different and from the Buddha. But once somehow I would see the Buddha almost as somewhere in between Jesus and Socrates. There's a lot more argument in the Buddha, you know, the Socratic type, that you get, whereas Jesus is more enigmatic and pithy and doesn't actually argue his case in that same way. Could you say a bit more about
that? Yeah, I mean, I disagree about the argument, actually. I mean, he throws over the money changers tables and all that, of course, but that's on one side. I was actually having a very interesting discussion with a Buddhist writer you might know, Stephen Batchelor, just fairly recently, and Stephen Batchelor has this idea that the Western Buddhism has just begun to ask the question of the historical Buddha in the way that a century or so ago Christians asked this question of the historical Jesus. The same thing's beginning to happen in the West, in Buddhism. And he just thinks it's going to take a long time. He said to me that when Buddhism first hit China and Japan, it took 5 centuries for Zen Buddhism to emerge, as it were, an authentically Chinese and then Japanese version of Buddhism, if you like. He thinks that that's what's happening with Western Buddhism. We're about 2 centuries in. It was the generation of Schopenhauer and Nietzsche that first encountered Buddhist texts a couple of centuries ago. And you've got to do the work of making the authentic Buddhism for the West. And the risk, if you just kind of import Eastern ideas without really building them into what you receive from the West too. So an obvious point of tension would be ideas of Buddhist anatta, no self, against strong ideas of the self in the West. If you just kind of obliterate one in favor of the other, you lose the roots. You lose it connecting to your actual life, and you just kind of, as it were, put a Buddhist mask on. So we've got to do the work, and we won't see the end of it, Stephen Batchelor thinks. But the work has begun, if you like. Yeah, but 2 or 3 more centuries to go, he thought.
I have 2 questions. The first one, do you have an extra handout?
I don't. I mean, maybe people are leaving them behind, or I have this blog website, markvernon.com, so I'll stick it up there.
Yep. Okay, my serious question now. You might have heard of Vrede's work on the messianic secret in Mark, and the idea of the Messiah being a different Messiah than the Messiahs in first century Judaism is because of the suffering Messiah of Christ. and he hid his identity from other people until the resurrection. And I wonder if the philosopher Christ would be a different philosopher because of the suffering philosopher, that the sacrifice of Christ was not a Stoic idea, maybe. Or even Socrates, you know, sacrifice was not exactly similar to Christ's death on the cross. I don't know if you could comment on that.
Yeah, I mean, well, a slight tangential comment, but esoteric ideas always gather around these axial figures, around religious figures. And they gathered around Jesus. And to this day, you have the mystical traditions, you know, more or less orthodox, if you like. And similarly, Neoplatonism particularly too became a very mystical tradition. More in a narrower point, but maybe a more sort of sharper point would be to say that you remember that, you know, the expression Jesus used apparently of casting pearls before swine. I won't cast my pearls before swine. The idea that people have to be in the right place in order to receive what's being said. And that if you're not in the right place to receive it, it's either going to seem like mumbo jumbo or like some kind of secret, and you're going to react against it. Plato has Socrates say the same thing. So Socrates in some of the dialogue says to some of the individuals he's encountered, I'm not talking to you. You won't understand what I'm saying. I hold secrets which are just beyond you. Now, I personally don't sort of see this in a Dan Brownish kind of way. I see it as, because these encounters are about the whole person, they're about your character, who you are, as it were. And unless you have ears to hear, you won't be able to understand what's being said anyway. And in fact, if you're a great moral teacher, you might well make the judgment it's best not to say it, because it'll only mislead, misunderstand people. Slightly above my pay grade myself, but that kind of idea of secrecy is both there in Plato as well as in Christian tradition for sure. I don't think there's a poetic tradition like that, but certainly, you know, Socrates, because he dies, becomes in iconography, and also subsequent figures trying to die in the same way that Socrates died. So one of the most famous was the tutor of Nero, Seneca, and Seneca tries to die in a Socratic way. It rather messes up; it's a bit too contrived, but that'd be something, perhaps, along the lines which you're talking about. Yeah, sorry not to be completely clear about that, but something like that, anyway.
Thank you, Mark, for your very clear talk. Just a couple of things that confused me. The first was that John Dominic Crossan wrote that book about 20 years ago, and about 10 years ago he wrote a book called Excavating Jesus with an archaeologist, where he backs off from his virtue, from his position of Jesus Stoic. I just wondered, you know, Jesus cynic, sorry. Just wondered if you want to comment on that. And secondly, you say the historical Jesus is virtually lost to us. I couldn't quite understand how you then at the beginning very helpfully compared him to Plato and said Jesus believed in, you know, the Father God, Jesus believed in resurrection, Jesus believed in kingdom of God.
Yeah, yeah.
You seem to be able to make a lot of statements about the historical Jesus in comparison to Plato, and then you said we've lost the historical Jesus, and I couldn't quite see how they fitted together.
Yeah, no, it's a very fair comment. Just on the Crossland point, I would argue that he refines his idea rather than rejects it. So the excavations, for example, find Greek temples and all that, so he's kind of refining the idea rather than rejecting it, but maybe, yeah. There's the refinement of it, but we can argue about that. But yeah, point taken. That there's a story here for sure. I don't want to deny that for a minute. On this business about the historical individuals, the point is it's a kind of it's a work of detection, and you go through these processes of weighing up what's more or less likely to have been said. So you know, it seemed pretty likely that Jesus referred to God as Father, for example. We can't know for sure, but because the word Abba and all the rest is quite unusual, it seems pretty likely that was the case. What we get then are kind of, we get two things. We get these tangible glimpses through this process of weighing up. And similarly, people have done the same thing with Socrates. Plato definitely makes Socrates into a literary figure. He's not just reporting what happened to Socrates one day in the marketplace. He's trying to drive much more deeply than that. So he's making Socrates up in the same way that you see very different Jesuses in the Gospels. But what's going on there is that a struggle to interpret what you think is most important about these figures, how the individual comes to you, if you like, what is most vivifying about them. So it's not historical. It's this difficult word for us now. It's mythological. And we take myths to be that which is not true. Whereas, again, for the ancient Greeks and for most of human history, myths have been a deeper truth than can just be caught by making literal statements about what was and wasn't said. So it's that reason where one can say the historical Jesus is lost, but nonetheless, the Jesus event, this is what this phrase tries to suggest, still comes through in some way or other. Sorry, I didn't hear that. There are these weighed points. That there seems to have been similarities and there seems to have been differences. Yeah, it's a bit of a both-and attempt to say there are certain things which seem quite likely, though we can't know for sure. And the reason why there's weighted averages, if you like, so, you know, some people do stress the very apocalyptic Jesus, the Jesus who was an apocalyptic prophet, who seems really quite alien. Others stress Jesus of the social gospel, for example, and the kingdom of God is very tangible on this earth. People like Crossland have other ideas. There's going to be a scope. So the definitive historical Jesus, I would suggest, is never going to really emerge. But the value of doing these exercises, apart from just pure interest, is to try and make something of these individuals for our own day. I would suggest that's the kind of deeper religious, psychological intrigue that's going on with these quests. I see people are beginning to leave, so do feel free to do that, obviously, but maybe there's a question or two more.
Thanks. It's a very... you've opened a really interesting window, it seems to me, and I was just wondering... whether Jesus isn't really a mystic more than a philosopher, and that, in fact, the philosophers are a dilution of the identity of Jesus, and in the sense that many would argue that the message of Jesus is that you can only know God by loving as opposed to by knowing. Just to back that up, that as you're pointed to, there may have been Buddhists in the Middle East at the time of Jesus. And that current runs through the desert fathers and mothers, Denis the Areopagite, right through to the cloud of unknowing in England, which is all about not knowing, and that God is only known by loving, by the direction of the will. So what would be your comment on that?
I would agree with you. I think the problem is we have a misleading idea of what ancient Greek philosophers were. That we think of them as kind of philosophy professors who engage in rational argument to prove various things, who constantly ask the question, how do we know what we know, rather than how might we live? And in fact, if you read, you know, Plato was a tremendous myth maker. His most famous myth probably is the myth of Atlantis. But he taught other much more sort of personally moving myths, if you like, more mystical kind of ideas. And the Neoplatonists are the followers of Plato who really run with this and then inspire a lot of people like Meister Eckhart and various others, for sure. Socrates, again, this historical Socrates thing, if there's one thing we can be more or less certain he went around saying, was that he knew nothing. And that was the beginning of wisdom for him. So the cloud of unknowing, I don't know whether the author of the cloud of unknowing had read his Plato, but it seems to be, at least in part, in a kind of similar spirit, and that the more we ascend, as it were, the less we know. A bit like Moses going up the mountain, ascending into darkness, you know, rather than light. All these ideas seem to be a similar strand. Yeah.
It's been an interesting thought experiment, but does it really just kind of stay at that? It's opened up Jesus, but is it almost like reading back into Jesus? So it's sort of the same thing as Jesus the communist, Jesus the feminist, Jesus the conservative, or the bodhisattva. We read what we want to see in Jesus into the event. Is Jesus the philosopher just the same as that?
It is, to a degree, yeah. But I think that the difference is that we always do that anyway. So the question is, are we going to try and do it a bit more consciously and be a bit more, try and be a bit more discerning, and again push to not just the image of Jesus as well we come up with, but what is communicated through that image, what's beyond what we'll ever get to grips with anyway. That seems to be this business about being human and being aware of what we don't know. It's this desire for what's not just humdrum or sewn up, or we can say, yeah, we've got that sorted. That way doesn't lead to more life, it leads to a kind of stasis. So I agree with you, and I just think we should perhaps, if this thought experiment's worth anything, it would be to suggest that this is the normal way of proceeding, in fact. Yeah.
Mark, our time is nearly up. It's been a fascinating talk and great questions and answers. Ladies and gentlemen, Mark Vernon.
Thank you. Thanks for coming. Thank you.